Seeing that it is past the time of 2:15 and there are at least three members here, we will start the testimony for the start the material for this meeting, and we're starting with Minnesota Public Radio. We have listed Brian Newhouse, Brett Smith, and Lisa Rodzik. Lisa, are you directing people?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lisa Rodzik. I am the Managing Director for Public Affairs and Government Relations at Minnesota Public Radio. At the table with me today are Mr. Brian Newhouse, head of classical NPR, and Mr. Brett Smith, a full-time classroom teacher and also a full-time music education coordinator for NPR. You will be hearing from both of them in just a moment. We are here today on behalf of the Minnesotans in Greater Minnesota who rely so much on NPR's cultural programming, the Minnesota artists who have been able to sustain careers in the arts because of NPR's legacy fund investments, and the students and teachers in Minnesota classrooms who are seeing music come to life in new ways because of classical NPR's emphasis on education. It is on behalf of these Minnesotans that NPR is grateful to receive grants from Minnesota's Legacy Amendment Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund to invest back into Minnesota communities. We very much are looking forward to the work we are planning for FY 14 and 15, and with your support, we are requesting $3.2 million for the projects we hope to invest in. Minnesota Public Radio is the only broadcaster in Minnesota that has a statewide broadcast signal. This means NPR is uniquely positioned to bring our programming statewide to Minnesotans in Roseau, Grand Marais, Worthington, La Crescent, and everywhere in between. Each week, a million Minnesotans tune in to our three services, NPR News and Information, The Current, and Classical NPR. And we know they tune in to our experience, award-winning artistic programming, and stories that reach back to tell Minnesotans more about our shared history and our cultural heritage. Beyond radio, legacy funds investments are providing us the means to show up in person in these communities, to record ensembles from greater Minnesota communities, and to bring internationally acclaimed artists to small Minnesota towns and classrooms in greater Minnesota, thereby inspiring students in new ways. We know this because listeners tell us that the cultural programming and historic information that NPR provides listeners can be a cultural lifeline to helping communities feel connected to the arts and our shared history. In addition, NPR is doing some incredible work here in the Twin Cities. NPR's The Current, heard here in the Twin Cities on 89.3 and streaming online for statewide listeners, is doing nothing less than putting Minnesota on the map as a place where musicians are able to earn a living with their art. The Current is giving local musicians a stage and a really big microphone where they wouldn't otherwise have had one, and it is making all the difference to the local music scene in Minnesota. And now on to classical NPR. I want to turn now to two experts from NPR who are investing their time and talents in one of NPR's legacy projects. Mr. Newhouse and Mr. Smith would like to tell you a bit more about the music education initiative that we at NPR are very excited about.
Madam Chair and
yes.
And members of the committee, my name is Brian Newhouse. Microphone often do this to me.
But we do have a cell phone on.
Oh. Wow. Okay.
They do it if they get, even if you're not, it's not ringing.
Yeah.
Do that if you get too close to the mic.
Sorry for the derailment there.
That's okay.
My name is Brian Newhouse. I'm the managing director of Classical Minnesota Public Radio. I oversee the staff and the programming that serves the network of classical music stations in the state of Minnesota. My colleague Brett is going to talk more about the specifics in just a minute of our music education initiative, but I'd like to provide the context of how we got here to this point. We've seen the legacy fund investments as a way to more directly connect with the communities we serve beyond the traditional radio broadcasts of our classical programming. Our mission at Minnesota Public Radio is to enrich the mind and nourish the spirit, thereby enhancing the lives of our audiences and assisting them in strengthening their communities. That's a mission I actually take very seriously, and it's what gets me up every morning. 2 years ago, we began a process of actively soliciting.
Madam Chair, could we do this through the NPR airwaves?
Can I move down here?
No, I don't think it's.
Hello?
If you have cell phones turned off, it isn't you guys.
So. My cell phone, I think, just left the room, so I'm not sure what...
Does anyone, if anyone here has a cell phone, they should turn it off. Okay.
Okay, if I try this one, we'll see how this one goes. 2 years ago, I began a process of soliciting feedback from educators across the state, simply asking them about their daily lives, their daily work. And we discovered that music educators in particular have been reduced nearly 30% in the last decade. Their class sizes are overwhelming to those teachers who remain, and they lack resources, they lack time. And this is in spite of all the overwhelming evidence that shows lifelong benefits of a rich arts education program, especially music. And we know from empirical research that music education benefits students' work in science, reading, math, and at the same time, it simply gives kids a rich experience of one of the humanity's greatest gifts, and that's music. So the challenge I put to my teams is, how do we respond to that? As a media organization, what can we do for our kids, for our teachers, and our communities, because we take this mission so seriously? How do we enrich the mind and nourish the spirit, and at the same time live up to the charge of the Legacy Amendment to expand arts access in Minnesota? And that's how our Music Education Initiative was born. And I want to turn things over next to Brett Smith, a full-time music teacher by day and NPR's Music Education Coordinator by night and weekends. Brett.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it is that I have 2 feet in two realities as a music teacher and also working.
Just a second before you start. We do have a quorum present now, so I'll call the meeting to order. And the we do have the minutes before us of the 26th of February and the 27th of February. And Representative Erdahl, who's been here long enough to read them, moves the acceptance of both minutes.
I think they're very good minutes.
Yes.
Thank you.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So as a music educator in Matamidi and also working with Minnesota Public Radio as their education coordinator, it gives me a foot in two different realities and a beautiful opportunity to express the needs of teachers and also to encourage programming through Minnesota Public Radio that can really help in many ways. I'll just briefly talk about the programs that we're working with. We're creating a series of videos that really meets the needs of teachers with specific standards as a focus. Those standards that are hard to meet in the classroom with diminishing resources and time and professional development. And yet with the YouTube opportunity through smart boards that are in so many classrooms and beyond, that those teachers can take those videos and then make it accessible to their kids throughout the state of Minnesota. Topics including improvisation, teaching that in the elementary classroom on an ORF instrument or on their recorder, the STEM curriculum, science, technology, engineering, math, teaching how to compose music, the beautiful work that Liz Jocola, a Native American Ojibwe Anishinaabe music educator, who is part of our Artist in Residence series, and as well will have a video so that the music teachers of the state can then access her great teaching and meet the standard, which is part of what we as music educators are to do. So the videos are one of our programs, the Artist in Residence another. This month we will be in 25 schools reaching 12,000 kids throughout this great state, and diverse populations, English language learners, students from a variety of economic, socioeconomic, economic backgrounds. Every child is given a CD that we're able to produce in-house, and it includes all of our artists in residence for this academic year. They are able to take that home. The curriculum is anticipated, where the music teacher, in advance of that performance in the school, is receiving the information that they need to support the performance. It lives on the web, and other teachers that are not in schools that are not there have a chance to access that throughout the state. We're also working hard to put the ensembles of students throughout this state on the airwaves. We have a rich tradition in Minnesota of phenomenal music ensembles from the elementary through the high schools and beyond. And for us to be able to expose, present that through Minnesota Public Radio is a great way for our greater community to know the great music that is happening in our state. And then to inform our work, we have an advisory council of 10 music educators from across the state, Duluth, Austin, Savage, Stillwater Hopkins, and beyond, that are experts in their specific field that come together, whether it's on the web or here in St. Paul, and help advise us as to how best meet the needs in this challenging time. I personally have 680 students that I connect with on a weekly basis, and for many it's even more. And so our job is to work to meet those needs and take the resources of Minnesota Public Radio. And just a last aside before we share a quick video clip. It's been a rare experience, as I've been teaching since 1985, to have a business or a corporation that has approached schools without a profit motive, saying, how can we help? What can we do? Not how can we sell more of XYZ product, but how can we help make a difference in the schools? So an example of the videos that we put together, and realize that this audience is for young children, is here to show you as well. This is the STEM curriculum and just a snippet of what we've been doing.
Sound is a powerful force. All right, you've made your point. Now, to demonstrate. All right, didn't I ask you to stop with the Nuba?
Sorry, just sort of slipped out.
Mm-hmm. Where was I?
Sound energy.
Right. Okay, but since you can't see sound energy, what do you think it looks like? I think we should all put on our thinking caps. All right, now, what do you think sound energy looks like? Yes?
A big ball.
A big ball? Ooh, that'd be cool. How about you?
A laser.
A laser? Ooh, interesting answer. Anyone else?
A wave.
Ding, ding, ding. That's exactly right. It looks like a wave. And if you could see it, it would look kind of like a wave on the ocean. Look at this. Here's the ocean. And this rubber ducky is your ear. Now this is sound. Watch. Did you see the rubber ducky move? Even though the sound is far away from your ear, you can still feel it because of the invisible waves. Isn't that cool?
This video helps to address the science standards in third grade and make it very accessible in a way that is kids understand the science of sound. And that's our effort through a variety of the videos that we're putting together. So I pass it back to Lisa and look forward to any questions you may have.
Madam Chair, members, that concludes our testimony. We want to say thank you for your time and thank you for your support of MPR. We appreciate it very much. And we look forward to your questions if you have any.
Okay. The questions from members of the committee? You are requesting a certain increase over last biennium. And so what's the thrust of that increase?
Madam Chair, you mean why are we asking for an increase? What you just heard before you right now is among the bigger reasons. We're significantly increasing the classical music education content and resources we're providing in the Minnesota classrooms. Hopefully, are hoping to do more in greater Minnesota in addition to that which we just talked about. Also doing more to engage and build on the rich choral tradition we have in Minnesota. We haven't yet tapped into that, and we know that I think nowhere else in the country that choral music is so important. We believe it has something to do with our Lutheran tradition and church choirs. We're going to do more with that, including some live events both in the cities and beyond. Also doing more with the local current, doing some traveling with the local show, bringing folks to Duluth and having more events around it. And also engaging more college students with the current and journalism students in greater Minnesota to help us feed content on our blog and whatnot.
Representative Bertle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Radzik, how did the funding mechanism work for you last time?
Madam Chair, Representative Bertle, we appreciated the legislature's efforts to promote transparency, and we think a competitive grants process is one way to do that. In our experience, hindsight being 2020, we would have asked the legislature to do more to set up criteria to provide guidance to the department administration around how the competitive grant would have been administered. I believe the Department of Administration, I'm not sure if they're here, they could speak themselves to the fact that they agreed that there was a lack of sort of what constitutes a proper grant. It was just very vague from their perspective. So if you all decided to continue with that, we would ask that there be more specific criteria set up for guidance for their benefit, and which ultimately benefits us. Our interest is in making sure every dollar is maximized for the taxpayers, and we want to do that in as transparent and open process as is possible.
What happened in the biennium before? Was there specific appropriations made to each group as opposed to a competitive grant process? Was there an oversight agency over?
Yep, Madam Chair, members. It was as is for a lot of other organizations still today. You all made a direct appropriation in legislation, and just as I think every organization, there's a agency by which it needs to run through. So the Department of Administration has been our agency, so we're accountable to them. We have to track our spending and our funding, our grants through them, whether it's a direct appropriation or a competitive grants process.
Okay. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Radzik. The basic difference is obviously a direct grant or competitive grants, and through the direct grant, really don't have with the agency it's going through, didn't really need criteria because you're getting that money. Did you feel that NPR was treated fairly by the Department of Administration in the last go-round?
Ms. Grabson.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, fairly within the context of the process, yes. The one downside is, as I have already said, the lack of criteria led some of the results to be, I don't want to say questionable, not questionable at all, but for example, the Department of Administration has told us that because there wasn't more criteria provided to them by you all, they felt that they needed to make that they sort of left some things up to the citizen panel that selected the projects that would be funded to make their best attempt at what they thought should be funded through the legacy amendment. And so what you ended up seeing is panel in FY13 had a different interpretation of what the legacy amendment should fund than the panel in FY14. So we saw from a $1.3 million amount in FY12 to a $1.1 million award in FY13, mostly just because the panel had sort of a varying opinion on what should be funded with legacy, where if there was more criteria from the committee, it wouldn't have, I don't believe that would have happened. So we were treated fairly within the context of the process that you all set up, yes, but could there always be improvements? We think there could be, yes.
How was the panel set up?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I looked up the language, but this was some months ago. I believe maybe Representative Erdahl could speak to this, the legislation itself said a citizen panel. I believe it was that, and I think it was in the spirit of Lasard Sams having a citizen panel. I'm making that up right now, but something along those lines, that a citizen panel from the arts community, maybe some in the audience even have a better sense of this, because I think some of them here have actually served on the panel. Members from the arts community would help determine the final grantees or something to that effect.
And that was they were appointed by the Department of Administration then, and so forth. Is that?
Madam Chair, that's correct, yes.
Okay, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Radzik, perhaps we'll have the information here by the time I'm done talking. But one of the reasons why I'm asking these questions is because, as I have said probably countless times in this committee, we're a work in progress. Trying to find, I mean, this is such a new thing, trying to find what works and also what can pass sometimes. And so I appreciate the suggestions that we needed, if we continue down this road, we might go a different road. But if we do, that we need criteria to be more clear. So appreciate that.
One of the points I've been trying to emphasize to people, and I don't know if this was stipulated or just implied, but there was, at one point, there was a sense that the supplementing and not supplanting meant that everyone had to come in with a new project every year. And I'm less interested in doing that. You know, we're very interested in making sure that we're not supplanting, that we're not covering things that used to be covered by some other part of the state budget. But if one started a project that was a good project under legacy, and there are reasons to continue it, I think, at least that's my personal opinion, is that there's no reason why we would object to that. Of course, we'll see what happens as we look at projects and go through the process. But is there any thought from the review about that aspect, and have you been thinking about this year in terms that you might have to have something new, or are you looking at extension of these projects?
Madam Chair, members, we're always aware of that supplement versus supplant sort of discussion that seems to always be kind of an undercurrent. Certainly, the projects that we're doing, some of them have been done before. In that realm, those same projects, we're always trying to improve on them. So there's tweaks and improvements and some notable differences. For example, making more of a concerted investment in taking something to rural Minnesota or greater Minnesota. So in some ways, in any given project will look like an entirely new project. But we've taken guidance from you all and from the Senate. More or less, you've been saying that same thing all along in the last couple go-rounds, that just because it's new with legacy doesn't mean it needs to be, you need a new project every year. So we're not, I would say at this point, driving our decisions by that sort of concern.
And you also get a general fund appropriation from State Government Finance Division?
That's correct, for our stations, our equipment in Greater Minnesota.
In Greater. Okay. Are there any other questions from committee members? Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Next on our list is the Minnesota Humanities Center. And Dr. O'Fallon is starting us off, President and CEO. What? We seem to be having some problem with noise. We ask anyone if they're sitting there, if they have a cell phone, to turn it off. But otherwise, just speak louder and don't get irritated.
Thanks, Madam Chair and members. Does it sound okay? And I thank my colleagues at NPR for leaving the humanities video up earlier. Thank you. A little extra. A couple of things I want to do today briefly. You have a very short PowerPoint we want to walk through, and then you have a folder with some educational materials in it. So let me just take us through the PowerPoint very briefly. We are the Humanities Center. We're in our 42nd year. We're an affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Here's our mission: build a thoughtful, literate, and engaged society. And yes, we mean that. I think it's a really good idea right now to build a thoughtful, literate, and engaged society. The unspoken mission, the one that I feel passionate about, is one I've mentioned before, but let me say it out loud again. It's kind of a divisive time in many ways.
You think being thoughtful, literate, and engaged would be a qualification for a legislator? You don't have to answer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for letting me off the hook on that one. I would answer it more generously, like it should be for every citizen of this great democracy. We should be thoughtful and literate and engaged. The unspoken mission, my personal one, and the one we feel strongly at the center is, what can we do in a divisive time to find out what connects us rather than what divides us? What's our common human community? We're working on that. I'm really proud to say that because we have no authority, we have had over 100,000 people from 200 communities work at the center over the last few years. We don't regulate anything. We don't license anybody. We have no authority, and 100,000 people work with us. I like the feel of that. And here's the map. We do work all over the state. We make grants for lifelong learning, adult learning, K-12, and so on. We'll get a little bit more into that in a minute. And regards to the previous conversation about guidelines and so forth, we draw a lot and paid some serious attention to the following fact that, whoops, something happened there. Interesting. There is a 25-year vision and a 10-year plan that roughly guides the arts, cultural heritage, legacy funding. And the Minnesota Humanities Center, the State Arts Board, and the Minnesota History Society were charged with being agencies with a special responsibility for creating that plan and for stewarding the funds going forward. So those are the three, and we can go right on, I think, from there. And here are some principles that I think guide legacy funding, rooted in principles that guarantee the greatest positive impact with as many Minnesotans as possible. We take that very seriously indeed. And the 10-year plan had some measurable goals. Is there increased engagement? Is there greater access? Is there greater transparency? Do we have new collaborations? And is there a funding continuity of some kind? I think these are good principles. There were a few more, but we highlighted those. Go ahead. And this is something you know, but I think it's worth calling out. The state is changing. Minorities accounted for more than 80% of Minnesota's growth. You can see the rest for yourself. We have a rapidly changing state. As some of you know, I grew up in Litchfield, Minnesota, and that is a rapidly changing community, as is Blue Earth to Black Duck to Duluth to the metropolitan area. And the Humanities Center, if we're true to our mission, thoughtful, literate, engaged, and what connects us rather than what divides us, then how do we find connections with the multiple communities, ancient and new, in our state? Just so you know, here is our general fund appropriation from last time, $474,000. We leveraged that. We raised over almost $500,000 in private funds and community contributions to our programs. We're an affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities, so over the biennium, that's $1.3 million. You can do the math. It's about $650,000 a year. Legacy funds, the appropriation last year was increased to $3.1 million. The governor's recommendation this year is a little bit of an increase, $502,000. And no, I don't have a cell phone alive on me right now.
We're trying to... We sent out to do that.
Gremlins in the work somehow.
Yeah.
I could turn the mics off.
No.
Do we need them?
No.
Doesn't matter. All right. The 3.15 appropriation, I would like to request an increase for you to think seriously about, up to 3.6, and I'll give you some reasons for that as we go forward. So let me just bookmark that. Here's what we did with the funding last time. $500,000 for civics education grants. We had almost $900,000 worth of requests. Now, look at this. This is $500,000 over the biennium, so $250,000 a year. This last year, we had almost $900,000 worth of requests in 1 year for fundamental civics education. CLUES is the largest Chicano Latino service organization in the state of Minnesota. You see the Dakota Tribe on there and many others. The Minnesota Campus Compact serves multiple campuses around the state. I'm sorry for the noise, but I don't know what to do.
They tried turning the microphones off, and they didn't. It didn't stop it, and so they think it's a fan somewhere in the equipment, and an engineer is looking for it. So it's none of us will.
The next slide is what we did with the biennial $650,000 appropriation just to the Humanities Center itself. We're deeply invested in education across Minnesota. We create new content, new materials. I'll show you more about that. We're really proud to be home to the State Poet Laureate, which we helped launch her. We work with TPT in new collaborations, and we've collaborated significantly with the Department of Education on important conferences on education, on the achievement gap, on what I call the relationship gap, on closing that. And then, last year we took on a new responsibility for children's museums. So we did grants to Children's Museum, and we had clear criteria, measurable criteria, and evaluative, appropriate evaluation built into the grant-making process. And I would just put a nod at our colleague and friend, Michael Garcia, from the Duluth Children's Museum. We don't see this as grant-making, although it is. We see it as a collaboration, so Michael is here as well. And we have made over $1 million in grants over the biennium in a challenging and creative and wonderful collaboration with the Chicano Latino and Asian Pacific and Black Minnesotans and Indian Affairs Council. This has been, I think, productive work. We've each magnified what the other person, the other organization can do. I'd like to highlight a little bit of that on the next slide. These are new publications created because of the collaborations with the council. So helping Hmong, second and third and fourth generation Hmong, young women coming back into or rejoining or finding their way into this wonderful democracy that we have. Somali bilingual books and award-winning books and publications with the Council of Black Minnesotans. And something that I'm really proud of, it's in your packet, it's in that folder we gave out, it's on the right-hand side, I just want to hold it up. This is a national award-winning project, Why Treaties Matter. We did it in cooperation with the Smithsonian, the National Museum of the American Indian, and the Ojibwe and Dakota Nations. Somewhere close to 50,000 people have spent serious time with this across the state of Minnesota. And for those of you who know the checkered history of the greatest mass hanging in the nation's history occurred in Mankato. It eventually involved the Brothers Mayo. The Mayo Clinic has a certain sensitivity because of things they did as a result of that hanging. A Mayo Clinic came to the Humanities Center and said, we will fund you for a third edition of this exhibit, which the Mayo Clinic now has. So that it's an ongoing conversation. So the treaty project was an event, a conversation, and an exhibit. It's still ongoing.
This may be an aside, but what was the Mayo Brothers connection?
The accurate history is that the Brothers Mayo, upon the conclusion of the greatest mass hanging in Minnesota history, trundled down there and used some of the human remains for medical education. It's a wound that is still not entirely closed, and I know that Representative Erdahl knows it much better than I do at all. But the Mayo Clinic did approach us because of this exhibit to say, we need this so we can take the conversation deeper. And just a quick sidebar to that, Madam Chair, if I may, a core value, a deeply felt value of the Humanities Center is to make sure that the voices of those that have been marginalized, left out, untold, sometimes told or distorted inaccurately, this is a core value. How can we bring these voices of these peoples into public education and into public life? a lot of our programming, and you saw it in the publications and in this exhibit, the work we do in education is about exactly doing that. The two book covers you see here are brand new books created in collaboration with the Council of Asian Pacific, written by Hmong women authors and illustrated. And I did ask for an increase, and part of that is to support the work you've seen, but also because we have some deeply felt emerging programs. Veterans Voices and Twin Cities Public Television, and I want to hit the next slide, please.
But Dr. Fallon, we're going to try, and if we can take a very brief recess, we're going to try and turn this off and turn it on again and see if that works. I don't think it'll take very long. But
thank you.
Our engineer is behind. Okay, that's my fault. I should have let us just stay getting used to us instead of bringing false help. Okay.
But it's such a relief when it's off, isn't it, really? Okay. We'll press on. We don't have much more to share with you, but on the board of the Humanities Center is a Gulf War vet, Corinda Horton, and her quote is up here in front of you. And Corinda said to me one day, the voices that have been left out, let's see, who are those voices? Well, the men and women that this country has sent off to war, recently but also in the past. So I invite to join me two people who are leaders in creating a new project with the Minnesota Humanities Center. Sam and Krista, would join me, please.
We need your names, of course, for the tape and for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Trista Mattis Castillo, and I lead the Women Veterans Initiative for the state of Minnesota.
My name is Samuel Verdeja, and I'm an advisor and a participant of the Veterans Voices Project.
And Sam is a little modest. He's also a Vietnam-era combat vet. And we responded to Corinda's question, how can the Humanities Center help veterans use the humanities enter, to become a fuller part of community and life, and to begin to tell a different story about the values, the knowledge, the skills that can bring. So that's the genesis of the project.
So Madam Chair, committee members, I'm excited to tell you about this project, but I think the background noise is actually a great segue for us. Sam and I were sitting in the back, both of us with post-traumatic stress and our anxiety levels growing pretty high. And we thought, it's what a great way for you to understand who we are as veterans and to share our culture with that background noise going on. So, you know, in every opportunity, a lesson for learning and sharing. The Humanities Center reached out to veterans, and I got a phone call one day and said, we'll be part of this project, and it's such an exciting project, and I'd like to tell you about it now. I know a few of you already have the inside scoop and have heard me testify before, but we are doing a project with the Humanities Center. It's the first of many projects, and I believe it's in your package, but we are celebrating 25 veterans under the age of 40 who have returned outside of their uniformed life and successfully reintegrated to their communities, and we want to celebrate their contributions as members of their communities. And so we're working diligently to raise funds, to collaborate with other veterans organizations and civic organizations that work with veterans, to find these 25 veterans under the age of 40 to honor them and celebrate. We will hold a 5-star event for the first time this year. It will be an annual event ongoing, and we're going to do that on September 11th. As veterans, September 11th is a very important day, as all citizens. It's an important day, but we often find ourselves looking for what exactly it is we're supposed to be doing. It's not a day of celebration, but a day of memory. But it's also a day that changed all of our lives forever, and especially those who answered the call to serve after 9/11. And so we are going to take that day and instead use it to say what contributions our young veterans have contributed to society. So we are seeking nominations from across the entire state. We know that veterans live in all 87 counties, and so we know we have great veterans throughout the state that have contributed, whether it's in farming, schooling, education, in the humanities, music, art, business, and that's the kind of things that we want to celebrate. Not only do we celebrate those contributions, but it gives us the opportunity to create a mentorship program for other young veterans. When we return and leave our uniformed life, we often start searching for what our next mission is. And so to find what that mission is, this will be a way that veterans who have done it successfully can share that with other young returning veterans.
You know, so this process of finding them is going on right now.
Yes.
Is there an application form or do we have that in our packet at all? Or?
Madam Chair, members, I don't think it's in your packet. We're literally just producing it, but we can make sure that all the members...
Okay. We'd like to get it, and it's the kind of thing, particularly if you have an electronic transmission of this. Somehow, as I watch people pricking up around here, I have the sense it's the kind of thing that not only the members of this committee, but other legislators might like, getting lots of nods, might like to send out to their constituents. I'm sure you'll have a press release and all of that stuff. But just to kind of, it seems that something that could be a special invitation might be something that people would appreciate doing. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Madam Chair, we have worked already underway. When veterans decide to do something, we start working hard. And so we started literally the day after Christmas. We met at 8 o'clock in the morning, and we hammered this all out, and we've been working diligently since. We have a website. It's on the Minnesota Humanities website, /veterans, or there's a link on the homepage. And so there's an online nomination form as well. But we'll also send you a paper copy as well. We're taking nominations all the way.
Isolating the link to the website.
Although we will definitely
gave us enough information for most of us to find it, but the link to the website would. The link to that specific thing would be most helpful.
We will definitely do that.
Yes, Representative Corkerson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if it's just me, but this system is driving me nuts.
Well, we've already tried to do something.
Hey,
always. We needed
that's
to
that's my
you.
Biggest accomplishment of the session so far.
Okay, terrific. Representative Ward.
I'm afraid to talk. Madam Chair,
later, I'll turn it back on.
Madam Chair, thank you. And members, I sit on the public safety, and Trista, you gave unbelievable testimony about you and your husband. And members, I think that's online as well.
Yes.
And I would encourage you to just Google their names, I think, and you can see that a true personal story of our veterans, and thank you all for your service. That is very meaningful. My question is about this. So, and Madam Chair indicated that, you know, if you can get us the information, all of us would love to get this to our constituents in our districts. Once our constituents apply or whatever it is that you're going to do, what's the pro? Who's going to decide, and what's some of the qualifications and criteria?
That's an excellent question, Madam Chair and Representative Ward. Thank you for your comments. We have made this a broad category because we know that veterans contribute in their communities in a wide variety of ways, and all of it worthy of celebration. And so our qualifications are that if they're currently serving, you know, still in the uniform service, whether National Guard, Reserve, that they're in good standing. And I know that's vague. It was intentional that way. And that they have, if they've been discharged, that it's honorable or eligible for an upgrade. And that was really important to me because oftentimes, especially now after tragic events and the war, that oftentimes veterans leave the service under conditions that aren't necessarily honorable. But that doesn't mean that they're not using what they did learn in the military and contributing honorably to our society. And so that is one of the things. And then under the age of 40, and nominated either by themselves or someone from the community. So it's a pretty easy thing. If you know a young veteran that's doing awesome things, then we want their nomination. We have a selection committee that's on this board of 14 members, selection committee, that represents every age, generation, culture, and obviously men and women represented that will be doing the selections.
And branches.
And branches of service.
Yep.
We even have an Air Force person on board, too. So we'll make sure that, so there's a wide selection and that we're really seeking from all areas of the community and across the state. This year's event will be hosted at the Humanities Center in St. Paul, but we plan to move this around the state from year to year, and that we really want to reach across all 87 counties to find nominations and honor those veterans as well.
Thank you, and it just sounds remarkable. And the one question I had as you were discussing the criteria is, what was why now under 40? Most of us on this committee wouldn't qualify, but why under 40? Why not a veteran? Period.
Yes.
That has participated in our community.
Right. That is a great question. So first of all, this is a launch event of the Veterans Voices Initiative with the Humanities Center that will go on for a very long time, and we're going to grow this. And we thought we have to start somewhere. Under 40 right now, our veterans under 40 have the highest rate of suicide. They also have the highest rate of unemployment. And, you know, that's the news that we hear all the time is the needs of that group. And so, appropriately, you're all on the Legacy Committee. We want our older veterans who are already are mentoring our younger veterans to leave that legacy of hope and opportunity. And so we're starting there, and we already have our list of where we'll expand so that we're also honoring in the future, you know, our World War II vets, our Vietnam vets, our Desert Storm, and our peacetime era veterans as we move forward. But we're starting with the youngest, most critical population.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other? Representative
Hasman. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mine is maybe not even the appropriate time to raise it, except where does the, in our budgeting process, where is the line item for the Minnesota Humanities Center? Is it in education or
no?
In yours?
State Department.
Yep.
So, but maybe asking it here allows Mr. O'Fallon to help with the answer.
Mm-hmm.
As I was looking at where the money is spent, when I see K-12 education resources and workshops, Summit Conference on American Indian Education, YMCA Youth in Government, addressing the education achievement gap, and even to a certain, and then the Reading Together Project, and even to a certain extent, seeing that Twin Cities Public Television, which I thought comes directly to us. I'm confused about its fit here as opposed to, for example, the K-12 the K-12 budget. How did we kind of move into addressing the education achievement gap and funding K-12 education resources workshops?
Dr. O'Fallon.
Madam Chair and Representative Hausman, the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Humanities Center itself is a very long 45-year-old tradition of working in public education and especially filling in areas that maybe are harder or not as well addressed by other agencies and constituencies. So when I talk about, for example, the capacity to work in multiple communities to bring in and create new resources and bring those kind of quickly into public education and public life, there is a focus on meeting real state needs. So, and you're going to have to stop me, Madam Chair, because I can get really carried away with this. But let me finish this sentence or this thought, if I might, Representative Hausman. Beneath the achievement gap is something that we believe is actually a kind of relationship gap. So being able to work in deep cultural knowledge and education to bring into public education and public life voices, materials, understandings, and capacities that it's harder to do in other systems. That's a role I think the Humanities Center can play that is, in fact, part of legacy, because we're working deeply with these cultural communities to create strategies, avenues, resources, and connections. So it's not just a curriculum, it's a strategy, it's an approach, if that's helpful.
I guess, Madam Chair, I understand what the Humanities Commission is. Mm-hmm. What I'm just struggling with is how did we move in terms of legacy investment into K-12 education resources and workshops and addressing the education achievement gap?
Madam Chair, Representative Hausman, and members, one way in which that happened was that, and Representative Murphy might want to address this at some point, at the beginning of the legacy funding, the state, what it calls its Councils of Color and the Humanities Center were joined together, and there was a suggestion, and then the legislation helped us work closely together. So we sat down with the Councils of Color and said, what are your top priorities, major concerns in your community? What is compelling you as an advocate for your community and as an understanding commission for your community? And there's an array of projects, but one common element across all the councils was a concern for what was happening with their young people, and frankly, that some of the strategies that were being used were still not reaching their communities. And one critical difference, was, to be blunt about this, they said, at the Humanities Center, we're able to speak in our own voice, create our own materials, set our own priorities with the support of these legacy funding, and in other places, people tell us what to do rather than ask us how to do it better. So the legacy seemed to contribute directly to the spirit, the intent of legacy funding.
And I think, Madam Chair, my question would be, why very legitimate needs and argument. Mm-hmm. It's just that I'm not sure why you wouldn't either approach through your line item in state government or through K-12 funding. That's what confuses me, how we got sort of deflected into legacy when we're so heavily invested in
Dr.
the education
O'Fallon?
Achievement.
I
gap.
Think you meant, what is the total? Humanities has a pretty small budget item, maybe Ms. Roberts can tell us what. While we're looking that up, Representative Girdle, you want to get into this conversation?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. O'Fallon, for your very fine explanations. You must be a graduate of Litchfield High School to be able to be so articulate.
I own up to that, and I'm proud of it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Were you ever taught by Representative Erdahl?
All
agent.
All right.
Wrong agent.
Madam Chair, I've stifled myself a few times this year with various things. But I'm just wondering, maybe Representative Hausman, if you're getting at, I mean, do you think that this is not the place for civic education and some of these other things that we've been running through the Humanities Center?
I'm actually not even getting to civic education. I'm just looking at K-12 Education Resources and Workshops, mm-hmm. Summit Conference on American Indian Education, mm-hmm. Addressing the Education Achievement Gap, the Reading Together Project. There's just a heavy amount of the program that seems to be totally based in education and addressing the achievement gap, all worthy goals. But, I mean, if we have kind of compartmentalized our budget, where should those funding streams be? That's I guess, my...
Madam Chair, are you suggesting that this should be under the Department of Education budget?
Asking the question.
May I refresh, well, Madam Chair?
Dr. O'Fallon. I guess the question that I asked is on page 5. Mm-hmm. Where we see the leveraging support in the general fund appropriation and so the amount of the legacy funds.
Well,
okay.
and
Dr. O'Fallon.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hausman. To speak to a couple of those examples that you drew from the materials and to not put all of that into a K-12 bucket. So, for example, the Reading Together Project was an initiative from the National Endowment for the Humanities that was devised to build stronger communities, not necessarily to change K-12 education, even though it's a part of K-12 education. So it has a broader perspective than simply what happens inside the school. And when I say we hosted some conferences, we did that in collaboration with the Minnesota Department of Education at their invitation. Because again, we're smaller, we're a 501c3, we can move quickly, we can bring people together, we can convene people, we can get results. And in some ways, to use maybe an out-of-date analogy, but you know, we're sort of the skunk works in education. Like, we can meet, get things done, move on, and be creative in a way that the larger Department of Education finds harder. And again, the council sought us out to represent and to carry forward some of their concerns and voices and top priorities, to create materials in a way that I think is really appropriate for the Manatee Center and harder for others to do.
Okay.
I'd also like to have our BEPS project get lost.
Right. Could you imagine the Department of Education with that BEPS project? That's a rhetorical question.
Yeah.
We don't have anyone here on the Education Committee to defend them. Representative Lewis.
Just a comment that I'm on the Education Finance Committee, so I appreciate the comments and something to keep in mind. But one thing I wanted to know is projects like these, have they been going on since before the Legacy Amendment was in place, these education K-12 projects?
Dr. O'Fallon.
Madam Chair, Representative, again, the Humanities Center has always been involved in public education to a certain degree, but with, I think, quite frankly, the pioneering and game-changing involvement with the State Council of Colors, we got involved in a deeper understanding of the changing cultural landscape of this state and the capacity to create materials, to bring people together, to bring up voices that had been left out in a way that the center had maybe done pieces of before, but never in this depth or with this capacity. I have been, as some of you know, in education and education reform and transformation, you know, for like a really long time. This is the best work I've seen in terms of making multiple cultures assets and resources to the state in a variety of ways. I've never seen anything this good. So again, the National Endowment for the Humanities is in fact largely about public education in many ways, and has always had programs for the broader public, for schools, for teachers, for educators, in a whole variety of ways. But again, in a way that it would be hard for a state department of education or another unit to do.
Now, I may be the only person around here who still remembers this, but wasn't there an attempt at one point to privatize the Humanities Council, and then it made us ineligible for federal funding when we did that?
Madam Chair, I've only been there 2 years and 2 months, so
I know.
I'm not sure.
You're
correct.
Okay, Representative. See, it's, you know, it's what they call Iron Range Alzheimer's. You only remember the grudges. So, Representative Murphy,
Madam,
you want to say?
Madam Chair, I just would like to add that the constitutional amendment investment goals that were adopted by the Cultural and Outdoor Resources Finance Division, March 9th, 2009, has 12 principles, 12 goals, and what Dr. O'Fallon has pointed out has five of those 12 goals at least are addressed in the things that have been financed. And then if you look at the principles and outcomes, I can count those up, but the idea that have been presented in the funding of the things meet those principles and outcomes. Plus, Madam Chair, you said several times that you wanted to work with groups that were underserved and children. And a lot of the things that are in the Humanities Center
report of how they spent the legacy money certainly meet those underserved needs of people. And getting different people to talk together, outreach kind of things, is one of the goals of the Humanity Center, as well as the principles and outcomes of the Arts and Heritage Constitutional Amendment funds.
Okay. Thank you for reminding us of that, about that. We should continually say it every once in a while, and we should all have it in our folder. We can always pull it out and reread it. So it was certainly a good start to setting the Legacy Committee on its way.
We spent so many hours on it, Madam Chair. Yeah.
We're also passing out the thing that was referred to, the State of Innovation document. We may have a separate, more detailed hearing on it, but I thought since it was at least mentioned and we didn't think we had handed it out to anyone before, we take this opportunity to hand it out. Okay, Dr. O'Fallon.
Madam Chair, thank you for that, and Representative Hausman, again, to your excellent questions. I would say that part of what drove us in the ways we collaborated with the councils, collaborated with the Dakota and Ojibwe nations, was the spirit of the legacy funding itself, asking us to be innovative, to do something that hadn't been done before, to create some new projects, programs, and new ground. I don't want to get into, you don't have to be new every time, and so on, but this gave us an opportunity, literally, to bring people together, create materials, launch programs, and create collaborations that literally did not exist before. So it was an opportunity, and I think I feel very proud of the hard work the councils did with the Humanities Center, and not only the councils, but other participants across the state as well. Madam Chair, I would like to just, if I may, ask our other lead person to speak briefly to the Veterans Project, and I want to mention one more emerging program, not to keep everybody, but okay. I feel passionate about the next program, too.
Right. Thank you, yeah. David. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sam Verdeja, and I'm a Vietnam veteran. And I'd like to really briefly talk about impact and being given a second chance. Coming home from Vietnam, for me, I had the opportunity to have relationships with World War II, particularly World War II veterans in our community that were either mentors, community leaders, or fellow veterans who happened to have served in World War II. And that was a time of change in our community, because when I came home, it was during the Civil Rights Movement. And we all know the history. It was a devastating time for the fabric of America. And I'll tell you, World War II veterans were there for us, coming home, those that were in our community particularly. And what they were saying to us was that you have to keep moving forward, and you have to be a role model, and you have to progress your community and so on. Well, I think we accomplished that, but one of the questions that I asked myself, along with one of my fellow veterans recently, Vietnam veterans, is that what would we be like today or then had we had the humanities to help soften our reintegration back into society? And I won't get into the details. Tristan and both David have highlighted that. But what would we have been like had we had the opportunity to work with using the humanities as a cushion to help our reintegration process and to become advocates for change in the community, to be able to function in leadership positions? I need to tell you, it was a hard struggle for World War II veterans, and it was a hard struggle for Vietnam veterans, but we had the luxury of having the voices of World War II. Having said that, fast forwarding, nowadays, one of the reasons, just the question about why the under 40, well, I think a lot of Vietnam veterans in World War II, those that are still alive, merit recognition, but really, we have already gone through the loops and hoops as those era veterans of having been trial and error recognition, or in this case, we're experiencing a little PTSD here a while back. So my voice may be a little shaky because it's still filtering. But nevertheless, what I'm getting at is that what we're involved in with the Veterans Voices Project is very dynamic and is going to change the fabric of America because we know, if you know your statistics, and I don't have those in front of me, the majority of the workforce, the majority of parents, grandparents, the majority of citizens, leadership in this community are going to be veterans. We do not know as a community, and I hear this voice from the Veterans Administration, I hear it from others at the state level in key positions to say, that are saying, we are not prepared for the influx of veterans coming home. What are we going to do? The systems are outdated. The availability of resources is minimal, budget cuts and so on. But what we're looking at through the Humanity Center is a process that's going to help us help the new veterans coming home. So I think that what we have here, and I say this because Trista's here, I come from a man's military, and that's the reality. I was a Vietnam veteran, United States Marine Corps. I was not introduced into being affiliated with, in terms of women being in the military till in the last decade or so, and that poses a whole new set of challenges for us. So we really need to look at what is the process that we're going to use to help soften the reintegration of veterans in our society. It's going to have a major impact. We need to be prepared for that. We as Vietnam veterans, in collaboration with the Minnesota Humanity Center and other groups, are working to help develop a campaign to do that. And part of that is the Vietnam Veterans, or the Veterans Voices Project. So I just wanted to say that because we need to be prepared. And those of you who have served in the military or know anyone in the military, and I'm sure we all have relatives, know that unless you're prepared, and I'm not going to use the word combat, but unless we're prepared for the social change, the social fabric in this country, really is going to backfire on us. So we have a responsibility. Just in really quickly, in summarizing, is that unless we're proactive in our task with the Veterans Voices Project, in collaboration, and there's other projects that we're working with them in our community, but in terms of the veterans community, unless, and we're working with the Minnesota Humanity Center, it's an opportunity. We're being given, we, meaning veterans, to give back to a community that's coming home that is going to experience some very dramatic setbacks. It may not happen tomorrow. That's the new veterans. It may not happen next week. But I can guarantee you, as a veteran, that it's going to happen someday. And people say, I never thought it would ever happen in my community. Hello, this is our community, and we need to be conscious of that. So, again, having said that we're working to help. And, again, the question about under 40, we're going to start there, but it's certainly, I like David's thinking, as we're in it for the long haul.
We are.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Is there any other comments then, or any questions from members of the committee?
Madam Chair, may I make two more points very quickly? Not to keep you all, but the Veterans Voices Project we talked about, here's an emerging collaboration with PPP. As you, some of you know, they have been funded to create a series on the Constitution. They have turned to us. PPP came to the Humanity Center and said, would you help us have statewide conversations on the Constitution? We see this as a multi-year project. We'd like to be able to explore it some more. We're investigating it, but I wanted to highlight it for you right now. I think the state has been through a constitutional conversation and challenge already in many ways, and I think it's the role of the Humanity Center to help people really engage the Constitution, talk about it. This is not experts telling you what to think. It is, the spirit would be citizens in church basements and in restaurants and in schools and in communities and in churches talking about the Constitution, reading it, discussing it, and then able to draw upon expert knowledge going forward. So it's an emerging program. We're just investigating it. But it's possible collaboration.
How do you envision that collaboration working, some of it being on?
Madam Chair and members, PPP said to us, we'll give you all the broadcast capacity, all the collateral materials. We'll slice the one-hour broadcast into 8 or 9 minute segments, like on the Second Amendment or just on the Bill of Rights or on the whatever, if you will create other educational materials. And what we do very well is gather people in communities across the state with guided conversations on important elements of the Constitution. So a community could choose for itself, we want to just talk about the Bill of Rights. I'll give you a concrete example. Next week I'm up in Crosby Minnesota. Some people are vacationing in Florida. I'm going to Crosby, Minnesota to work with a large group of people, 50 or 60 people who are lifelong learners. They got a small grant from Minnesota. The subject will be, how do we in fact understand and engage our Constitution? How does it matter now? How is it real in our lives? How do we think about it? Because the nation and the state have had some important constitutional conversations. So this is a concrete example.
Okay. Is there any public commentary from anyone who's in the audience?
Madam Chair, I was just saying to Representative Hausman that we have tons of emails about the Second Amendment that we could turn over to the actual citizen input. And Madam Chair, I responded, it would be helpful if they focused on the first part of that Second Amendment.
Yeah.
You could have a whole session on the Second Amendment. Jeff, go away till they wait till you see what they come up with. No. Any other?
Madam Chair, if I may, just a final note, just the slide, you can read it for yourself, but we took very seriously the question of, so you spent a dollar, what happened? Did anything? Did you get anything for it? Did anything change? Anything get better? Did people talk to each other who had not talked before? So we are working closely with the Minnesota Evaluation Studies Institute, one of the best in the world at the U of Minnesota. One of their senior people, Gene King, is on the board of the Humanities Center. So we can evaluate these complex projects and see if, in fact, we make a difference. That's underway.
Going back a little bit, I guess one of the things I was interested in is the legacy amendment appropriations. I was looking at the ones where we had the funds for supporting the Children's Museum with grants. Again, what kind of evaluation do you have on the effect of those? What have you been done? And are you the evaluating group, or what?
Madam Chair and members, it was a grant, again, according to pretty strong criteria, and we invited in each of the children's museums to developmental evaluation workshops with experts from the university, because the real evaluation has to be done by the museum itself according to its goals. Did it reach new people? Did it create a new project and program? And though we took in final reports, but we had much more substantive conversations, and those evaluations are still underway.
Okay, the other one, on page 5, again, you're leveraging support.
Yes.
Has any of the legacy funds had an effect in the leveraging of support from other? This is sort of based on your general fund appropriation, and use legacy funds as an example of the extra support. Mm-hmm. What about the legacy funds themselves? Have they been used to leverage any private support or community support?
Madam Chair and members, I can give you an absolute concrete example right now. The Humanities Center, with our colleagues here, Tristan and Sam, made a commitment to the Veterans Voices Project, and that has already leveraged somewhere north of $30,000 in private funding. And we do the same thing with other projects. We look at what we can do, might be supported with legacy funding, what can the community contribute to it, cash and resources. So yes, part of that leveraging is legacy funding.
Okay. We don't need an answer to this right now, but that's, I think, one of the things, if you can give us some notes on that, specific mm-hmm. projects that you funded and the resulting, you know, the ask that was made for matching funds and the resulting match. Okay. Anything else from? Oh, is someone from the audience who wishes to say something?
Good afternoon.
Tell the committee who you are.
Yeah. Chairman Kahn, my name is Michael Garcia. I'm the president and CEO of the Duluth Children's Museum. And our organization is one of those organizations that falls under the Humanities Center administration for the legacy funds. In the first 2 years, you will remember that perhaps that we had a direct appropriation from the legislature. What I wanted to speak to were 2 points. One is the spirit of collaboration that the legacy amendment has created in terms of opportunities that I see reaching across the entire state of Minnesota. I worked for a number of years as a consultant for private foundations in Minnesota, and I used to often hear when revenues became scarce that administrators wanted our grantees to collaborate more. And my question always was, at what expense? Who's going to finance it? The legacy amendment in Minnesota has created a great deal of financial opportunity that has led to collaborations across the state of Minnesota, such as the one David O'Fallon has referred to with the evaluation training for professionals like me and my staff at the Duluth Children's Museum to engage in a discussion around developmental evaluation. It's a wonderful concept. It's an idea that we would have loved to have been part of early on, but it is because of the relationships forged by the Humanities Center through the Legacy Amendment that we've been able to participate in that. Additionally, we see legacy projects coming to the Duluth Children's Museum through so many avenues that it is extremely exciting and adding a great deal to the experience at the Duluth Children's Museum. Through the work of the Minnesota State Arts Board, artist touring grants allow artists like Sea Puppets to come to Duluth and to present and to perform in our venue for our youngest audiences. The Arrowhead Library Association provides passes that allow families that otherwise wouldn't be able to afford to come to the Duluth Children's Museum. The collaboration with the Minnesota Children's Museum in St. Paul to create the exhibit Storyland that toured to Duluth brought an opportunity for over 12,000 young people and their adult caregivers in just 8 weeks to come to the Children's Museum and experience that exhibit that Representative Murphy helped open up in the city of Duluth in early October in the cold. My point is that collaboration is often asked for but not funded. And through the Legacy Amendment, collaborations have been supported in a way that have created greater opportunities for the artists of Minnesota, for the cultural organizations, most of all for our citizenry. And I'm very appreciative of the work of the legislature as well as the voters in authorizing this legislation and making it possible for us to expand and do so much more. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Garcia? Thank you very much for coming. Oh, yes, someone else. Okay, sure.
Another. Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Diane Steinbach from Twin Cities Public Television, and I was here testifying last week. I just thought I'd clarify if there's any confusion, but I also wanted to second what the gentleman from Duluth said about the collaborations and the that have been made possible by the Legacy Amendment. But very quickly, we have had a partnership, as David mentioned, with the Minnesota Humanities Center from the beginning of both of our legacy grants being appropriated to our institutions, but the Constitution project that David's talking about is non-legacy funded. That is a national project that's been completely paid for with grant funds. And so it might be confusing because we have multiple departments, and that is not part of our legacy arts and cultural department that does use, and we do have a collaboration with the Minnesota Humanities Center, and that is they write our education activity guides for the arts and cultural segments that are part of Minnesota Original and our history documentaries. So it is a little confusing, and I just thought since I was here quite by accident, I would clarify it for you or answer any questions you might have. But I can't say enough about how we've both been able to benefit from the workshops that we're doing and trying to make sure that the material, the video material, what we're able to do is to take the Humanities Center education expertise and combine it with our production expertise and make sure that people, teachers, and students of Minnesota benefit from both of our expertise. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. That is
helpful. It's easy to get confused about all of these things. Another question that has come up separately is the issue, and has come up for several of these, is the issue of how we do the indirect cost funding. Mm-hmm. Have you thought that the way that was, I think, the first time we started with the percentage, the second time we went to this direct and necessary criteria, how have you thought about how that's worked out?
Madam Chair and members, we were pretty religious about the direct and necessary expenses, and as some of you know, the Office of the Legislative Auditor spent 300 hours auditing our legacy funding and discovered one final report that was not in on time, and I think a travel expense that maybe was $100 out of whack. So we were directly relating every expense to the actual project itself. What did it take to do that? So it worked better for us than trying to find a percentage of some kind, because the fact is that we spent our legacy funding and staff time on some other people's projects. So, and again, I think the impact has been very positive of our capacity to look at direct expense against results.
Okay. Any other questions or comments from committee members? Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Before we adjourn, we'll point out at the bottom of your schedule, and this is, I should probably yield to Representative Erdahl to more thoroughly explain this, but we have our next meeting tomorrow. It's actually the excitement of a joint committee meeting with the Senate, so we'll get to see those people for the first time. And it's 3 o'clock p.m. at 123 Capitol. And at 2:30, there's a press conference in Capitol 125. And Representative Erdahl, do you want to say a few words about that? We did send out a press advisory notice. So
Madam Chair, I think you've covered it pretty well. I'd just like to know why Representative Torkelson waited until over half the meeting to fix the sound.
He wanted us to really appreciate him. So.
That's exactly right,
Matthew. Will the Coen brothers be there tomorrow?
So, anyway, we're going to be looking into the issue of funding of movie projects in the state. So we're going to hear from the Film Board. We're going to hear from another possibility, which Representative Erdahl has been talking about a way of funding film in the state. Okay, any questions, comments? Hope you can all find your way to the Capitol. And okay. What? No, we are not meeting here at 2:15. Instead of that, thanks for clarifying that, Representative House. So thanks. So the next meeting has been changed to 3 o'clock at the Capitol. Okay. Meeting adjourned.